believe we'll get started now. I'd like you to welcome you to this session of the Sunstone Theological Symposium. I would remind you that admission to this session is by pre-printed name tag only. And the topic of our panel discussion today will be Between Two Worlds, the Artist in a Religious Culture. And now I suppose it's my job to kind of muddy the water a little bit, so this is what I'm going to attempt to do, and then I'll introduce the panel. The artist in the church sometimes finds difficulty in fitting himself into an institution and community which places value on unity and oneness, when his very creativity is constantly sending him afield, searching for new ways of expression. There are some implied and real constraints in the church on how and in what ways our faith should be expressed artistically. The artist wonders, perhaps, when this judgment seems to be made primarily on conservative cultural criteria rather than on real artistic merit. Are we as a people in a cultural trench? Should our Japanese saints really be singing hymns with European folk tune melodies and harmonized in a Western tonal system? And is it really not proper for our African brothers and sisters to worship with drums? Certainly the arts are useful to decorate, to illustrate, and to smooth the telling of the gospel to the world. But is literature useful only when it effectively tells a faith-promoting story? Painting and sculpture only as they skillfully depict scripture or the Mormon ideal? And music only when it has words to teach? Or is a work of art also, and more importantly, in and of itself, a revelatory experience? Perhaps we as a people need to focus more on the unique ability of art to express the mystical and personal nature of faith and religious experience. If so, then how do our artists feel about assuming a dual role of teaching us about art as well as creating it? Today, our panel will address these and other ideas and issues relating to the topic, and I'm personally very excited about what's going to transpire this next hour and a half, and I am very pleased at the wide range of knowledge and experience and understanding that is represented by our panel today, and I am delighted to introduce them to you now. Linda Sillitoe is a poet and poetry editor of The Exponent 2 and a writer for the Deseret News. Neil Hadlock is sculptor and painter and owner of the Wasatch Bronze Work. Bruce Jorgensen, an assistant professor of English at Brigham Young University. Hal Cannon, a member of the Deseret String Band and folk arts coordinator for the Utah Arts Council. And Georgianne Baliff Arrington, instructor in modern dance at the Brigham Young University and also a former member of the Ryrie Woodbury Dance Company. We'll ask them to each speak to you for about 10 to 15 minutes, and then if in the time that's remaining, we would invite your questions and also panelists' questions of each other. Linda, we'll have them speak in the same order that is in the program. I think if you'll come up here, it will be easier for them to hear.
In thinking about this assignment to talk about art in the community, it seemed to me that in some ways the two of us that are writers on this panel are in a little different position. Sometimes it seems to me that writing is the community as far as people who come to Sunstone Symposium go, that all of us, in a sense, are sort of writers, readers, editors, critics, some to a greater degree than others, maybe, but that writing makes up this sort of invisible network that somehow draws us in and brings us together occasionally, and brings us together in print at times when we're not together in person. And I've also been aware and been somewhat frustrated by the fact it seems to me that in Mormon culture, readers and critics and writers and editors tend to be interchangeable. And a lot of times we wear different hats at different times and we just keep switching. I don't think that happens in quite the same way with sculpture or dancing or music. And I think the result of that is, well, I think there are a couple of results. One is that writers end up talking about things that they really shouldn't be concerned about. And when I say writers, for this context, I'm going to talk about creative writers, people writing fiction and poetry, rather than journalism, articles, criticism, whatever. Because I think they are different. And we end up listening to discussions about writing, and sometimes the point of view in that discussion seems just a little bit off, or just a little bit alien, at least to me. And so since the time's limited, I want to just comment on things that I've been involved in the last year or so as a writer, supposedly, and yet it hasn't seemed to quite fit the way I feel as a writer, although it might fit quite well the way I feel as a reader or a poetry editor or whatever. Let me mention first Levina Fielding Anderson's presidential address at the Mormon Letters Association meeting in January. I want you to feel comfortable with this, and so I'll let you know that I already have Levina's authority to take her name in vain and defame her speech, and talked with her before this began. It's always a pleasure to listen to Levina talk, as I'm sure most of you know, and I really enjoyed this speech. And since it has since been published, I think in Sunstone, I won't review all of it, but just comment on a few particular points. She was talking about making the good good for something, and the good in question was Mormon literature. And as I listened to her, I got the uneasy feeling that that's kind of like taking a big bouquet of daffodils and putting them on the dinner table to enhance the evening meal, and then the next night boiling them down for a vegetable substitute so that they're good for something other than just, you know, being there. And even the introductory comments, is literature useful only as if it tells a faith-promoting story? There's something in me that just wonders whether it needs to be useful at all. I mean, it may be, but I don't like thinking of it in quite that way. I really appreciated Levina's endorsement of writers who are writing now in the culture, but her sense that we'd be put more to service in the public good and for the public appreciation, so that people would like us better and feel more comfortable with us, made me a little nervous too. And so while I was agreeing with much of what she was saying, inside I kept flinching a little bit, and it's taken me a while to sort of sort out those flinches and figure out why they were there. To paraphrase a little bit of poetry, if eyes were made for reading, then writing is its own excuse for being. It seems to me that if a work is really good, if it really does have literary value, if it stretches, if it's insightful and profound, moving, in some way enlightening, then it already is good for something. It's good for being good. And that's hard enough to achieve without also being useful. Levina also made the point that the Lord loves writers too, hard as it may be to believe, and that even those writers who take on some hard subjects, and she named a few, may in the end be building the kingdom. Well, I agree with that. And I agree also that maybe writers should see themselves in a more positive light, maybe not feel quite so endangered. But I think and I hope that anyone who wins that battle with the typewriter and the muse has also won a sense of self-worth. And I seriously wonder if any writer ever comes back from that hard confrontation and the heady sense of transport that writing involves and finds a poem sitting there in the typewriter and doesn't feel gratitude as well as relief and exhilaration. Surely writers know the source of those gifts that come from the blue and the swamp. Still, it's good for everyone else to know that writers have God in their corner, so to speak, and I think we are indebted to Levina for telling people that that's the case. After all her years at the Ensign magazine, Levina's frequently been heard to say that didacticism and moralizing and illustration seldom make good literature. And that brings me to my participation on a panel at BYU. And in this case, there are a number of writers discussing our own short stories. The theme for the entire day was reading is believing. Now, on one level, I accept that. People will accept an experience where they won't accept an opinion. You can say, this happened to me, or this happened to so-and-so, and people will believe it where they won't accept some sort of little dogma on the subject or opinion. And stories really do open worlds. One example is the Joseph Smith story that's been such an effective missionary tool. That has a way of reaching people that sitting down and talking with them about the Godhead might not. We identify with the person in the story if it's a good one. But when you're in a religious culture and you're discussing your own stories and the theme for the day is reading is believing, that implies that writing is directly related to the personal salvation of those people who are going to pick up your manuscript, and that's a pretty heavy message. It's also inaccurate. Partaking of the arts, whether you're reading or watching a play or looking at a painting or whatever, is the temporary suspension of disbelief, and that's different than belief. Belief is more integrated, it's more chosen, and it's larger than that kind of temporary suspension. If reading is believing, then writing is programming, and all of us in our roles as readers are simply robots. And yet there's something in being a Mormon that in some way hooks us with that, tells us that reading is believing, that if we enter an experience, somehow we've got to darn it into the whole true fabric of our faith. And that takes me to the third conflict, which was on another panel at BYU. This one was at a writer's conference. And I don't remember what it was we were supposed to be talking about, but we were talking about what we always talk about, which is whether or not there's an audience for what's being written, who's going to publish it, is this being written perhaps for non-Mormons, who should read this material. And then we start getting a lot of shoulds in, like, who should publish it? Who should read it? Should it be written at all? Why is it being written? Should anyone read it? And finally, sort of the underlying implication that maybe we should just burn it right now. I've never heard it expressed quite that extremely. It's always couched in the nicest of phrases. But I have heard that repeatedly, usually after reading some of my own work. And I think that maybe those things are things that need to be discussed. But I don't think that they need to be discussed by writers. Writers have entirely other conflicts to deal with. And those things don't have anything to do with the process of writing. It seems to me that they have to do with community acceptance, fear of reprisal, the missionary ethic, and the niceness that is valued almost above all else in our society, and that says tacitly, if you can't write something nice, don't write anything at all. And continues, and if you're going to write something not quite nice, for heaven's sake, don't write it about us. Some of the things that writers are dealing with, let me add parenthetically, are things like time, fighting inhibitions, dealing with personal guilt because bits of psychological or actual reality are creeping into what you're writing. There are so many internalized things that those other concerns of publication and audience and all that kind of thing, I believe, should be considered at an entirely different time and place and quite a different frame of mind than during the creative process, when what you really need to do is somehow come to terms with what it is that's going on inside of you and translate it into those little squiggly marks on the paper. And we do get frustrated when we only have nice things to read, even though we do have that value in the society. I think that as readers and as critics, we decide whether or not we're going to read, what we're going to read, and whether or not we like it after we read it. Those are the reader's prerogatives. The writers are quite different, and I think in some ways they're more limited, because a writer can only write what is given to be written. Those of you who attended Potok's address, sponsored by Sunstone last year, may remember a question that was asked near the evening's end. I don't know who asked this question, but I think I understand the kind of well-intentioned concern that was behind it, and also my own chill as it was asked. This person said, "What should we do as a Mormon community to produce a truly great Mormon author? One can visualize the committees being formed, the manuals written and correlated, the callings being made. If only we can assemble the right ingredients, we, the most pragmatic people of all, can whip up another Shakespeare just as surely as we can spirituality or Christian love or a happy marriage, which are all dispensed by recipe, as you know, at auxiliary meetings. As I recall, Potok said something like, well, there isn't really very much you can do as a community. You can read, you can publish, you can buy books, you can keep things alive from that end, you can support the work being done, and you can just wait and see what happens. And then, if you remember, there was a little strain in his voice as he said that he, in order to write about his culture, he had to get a little distance on it. He had to break away to some degree before he could really write about that inside world that didn't like outsiders getting too close. Now, that's hardly an answer that fits the context of any discussions I've heard carried out by Mormons in that kind, you know, in a discussion or a symposium such as this one. What I need in this culture as a reader and a critic and an editor and a writer is a lot of variety. I like to be able to poke around. I want to have choices in art and drama and sculpture and music as well as literature. And I don't have to like it all, and I don't like it all, but I want it to be there so that I can experience it and so that I can draw my own conclusions. And I think that if the pressures are great enough and if the culture really requires art to be useful and practical and institutional and palatable and homogenized pablum, then we just won't have any, and we won't have any artists, and I would miss that a great deal. Thank you.
I don't know if, since I'm not an established writer, I'm here as a critic or perhaps as a very well-established reader. I wish we could stop troubling ourselves about this. Without the church as institution, it seems to me I would not be just where and what I am. For one thing, insofar as I am on whatever modest scale a writer or a critic or whatever, I must also, as a teacher at BYU, somehow regard the church as my patron and acknowledge, I suppose, all the ambivalence that relation might imply. For another, and more important, I suspect I would not have the artistic and intellectual friends that I now have, some very good men and women whose presence in the world sustains and enriches my life. I might not even have Dialogue or Sunstone or this symposium. But all of that, I now have to argue against myself, sounds rather like the fallacy of hypothesis contrary to fact. And worse than that, it sounds terribly like Dr. Pangloss instructing Candide in the sufficient reasons that account for the maddening arrangements of this best of possible worlds. After all, he tells Candide, if you had not been driven from a fine castle by being kicked in the backside for love of Mademoiselle Cunegonde, if you hadn't been sent before the Inquisition, if you hadn't traveled across America on foot, if you hadn't given a good sword thrust to the Baron, if you hadn't lost all your sheep from the good land of El Dorado, you would be sitting here eating candied citron and pistachios. It's all very well, Candide says, but we must cultivate our garden. Be that as may be, I do find myself here, some sort of critic, intellectual, sometimes writer, in something we call the church. And there's my first quibble with the announced topic of this panel. I experience myself as in rather than between. For after all, what do we mean by worlds in this context? So far, I know of only one real world, which in Wittgenstein's phrase is everything that is the case, and which thus includes the church as institution and community, and writers and artists and critics and intellectuals and the things that they make and say and do. Elements of this one world often oppose one another, and Lehi would have it that this is necessary for there to be a world at all. Further, I would say that the world with which religion, though not always the institutional LDS church, is concerned, is larger and more substantially real than the worlds of either science or art. For if we really are agents and persons in relation, then surely, as John McMurray, the author of a book called Persons in Relation, puts it, he's dead now some years, A world without persons is not the real world. Science abstracts the person from experiment, observation, and generalization, though quantum physics seems to insist that at least the presence and position of an observing mind matter crucially. Art is also an abstraction from the plenitude of experience, as writers perhaps know most acutely. It is true that artworks and artists in their working often attend lovingly to particulars, and hence that art may come a step closer to the real world than science. But there are no real persons, no real personal relations in poems, novels, sculptures, symphonies, plays, ballets. Performers in those last three, yes, but present in the exercise of their technical skills in performance. The making of a work normally involves one person, and its reception by an audience is largely a matter of separate, private contemplation, perception. If by world in the context of art or ideas or scholarship or whatever we mean such things as, if we take the world of art, if we mean not the small simulated worlds of individual works, which Tolkien calls secondary worlds, but something like the world of art, the nexus of theaters and publishers and galleries or whatever, universities, symposia, journals, etc., then I don't really much inhabit that world, most often as a kind of onlooker, and I don't really mind. Well, I would mind not inhabiting the university, I guess. I'd have a hard time making a living. But of course, the world of the church, in a similar sense, that is the organization, its schedules, and its programs, is itself rather arid and uninhabitable, tedious when not ludicrous or exasperating. I think we all know that. And about my church in that sense, my sentiments are rather like those of Flannery O'Connor about hers. I'm quoting from one of her marvelous letters in The Habit of Being. She speaks of the necessary burden of the conscious Catholic and then says this: "I think that the church is the only thing that is going to make the terrible world we are coming to endurable. The only thing that makes the church endurable is that it is somehow the body of Christ and that on this we are fed. It seems to be a fact that you have to suffer as much from the church as for it. But if you believe in the divinity of Christ, you have to cherish the world at the same time that you struggle to endure it." I think the interesting shift there from church to world, that is recognizing the church as a rather secular institution after all, is an interesting shift. The true church, The church as institution matters to me for two reasons: the ordinances and the possible and occasionally actual fellowship of its saints and sinners. The true church, I rather suspect, that is, the body of Christ whose members are knit together in some kind of loving unity, exists only fragilely and intermittently in our moments of fellowship and genuine personal relation, which may or may not emerge from some moments of our activity in the programs of the institution. It is true that the attitudes, policies, words, judgments, and actions of church management and members at various levels — I'm using management in Nibley's sense, some of you know that recent address — at various levels may run afoul of our personal and professional feelings and judgments. But we are at least hypothetically joined to these persons as brothers and sisters in the bonds of charity, and I suspect that the burden of charity must fall most heavily upon us who think ourselves the most sensitive and conscious, as if we were. We can all recite stories about this friction of perhaps necessary opposites. Recently, two officials of my home stake offended everyone I've spoken to about their action by ordering the removal of an entire row of full-grown Chinese elms — I know they're trash trees in my hometown — from one boundary of our stake center lot. My wife and I had sat not 3 days earlier under the widest of these trees, absolutely marveling at the green shade. I think we turned into green thoughts in a green shade. And that's gone, and who knows why. And it was the decision of two people. Some years ago, I was counseled by an administrator whom I deeply respect as a teacher and in whose debt I forever stand for much of my academic career, and that the presence of my name on Dialogue's Board of Editors might in some way interfere later on with my possibly being asked to serve at high level. I tried to indicate my lack of interest in both high-level service and having my name on Dialogue's masthead. I asked Mary to take my name off the masthead and went on reading manuscripts, more or less at my usual dilatory rate. and I'm still available. Just don't put me on your masthead, because it doesn't matter, and I don't want to bother anybody. Again, back in 1978-79, when my short story won the All-Church Contest, this is my favorite story anyway, when my short story won the All-Church Contest, it was prudishly censored. All references to skin and the protagonist's gesture of kissing his sleeping wife on her temple were deleted. And the word grace in the last sentence barely scraped by. I suppose it was an act of grace that kept it in there. I like to think that. One of my friends said, I wish I could remember his exact words. He said, "Are you going to let them do that to you?" And I said, "Yeah, all right." I let the skin and the kiss go a little ruefully, because the story's celebration of bodily joy, joy in the physical world, could in no way be eradicated by such finicking deletions. And however small and modest the story is, I mean, it did say that. The episode seems sort of funny now. Okay. Lastly, I guess all of us remember February 1976. Remember 76. When an apostle berated church musicians for their highfalutin ways, and literature teachers for passing on a degraded literary heritage to their students. That may be one burdensome and necessarily oppositional function of the apostolic office, stirring us up to repentance or anger, or some sort of, in any way, we change, I suppose. In some ways, the criticisms seemed well taken, and however wrongheaded some of the ideas about music and art and literature may have been, others, especially in the context of the church as a potential community, seemed rather cogent. I found I could live with it after a few days of agitation, and it helped me generate at least one fairly good poem. Who can complain? I've never supposed that what I write and publish in poems, fiction, or criticism will speak to more than a few of my fellow citizens, but I hope that to such a few it does speak truthfully and, pardon me, Linda, usefully, and that few or none... that fewer, we ought to talk about what we mean by use, and that fewer, none, are harmed by it. Once in a while I learn, with a rush of grateful fellowship, that this has been the case. As writer and critic, I don't ask more from the church than that. In Chekhov's words, "I should like to be a free artist and nothing more, and I regret that God has not given me the power to be one." I wish I were as much a one as Chekhov was. Like Chekhov, I am perforce something more. He was a doctor, and I'm a teacher. And perhaps I have to be more still, a member of this particular church, a priesthood holder, trying to work out what consecration might mean in my case, and that's an idea that I take rather seriously. In that hard and perplexing labor, it is heartening to have not opposed to me, but apparently on my side, a genuine apostolic witness, the same who criticized me, apply these words.
Before I launch into my treatise, I'd like to pause and tell you that I'd much rather be dancing my 10 minutes than reading what I prepared. But alas and alack. And maybe before I start too, perhaps it'll help you understand my point of view. If I tell you that I am a modern dancer, it may make a difference. That's the area in which I've specialized in, not so much ballet or the other dance forms, but modern dance is my area. I hold my breath, as does Hal Cannon, when someone introduces me as an artist. I have so much respect and reverence for the title and feel so often that what I am doing in my art falls short. I feel comfortable defining myself as Gigi Arrington, instructor of dance at Brigham Young University, rather than Gigi Arrington, dance artist. The responsibility of the title is great, and I'm feeling the weight of that responsibility now, trying to attempt to communicate to you the frustrations and the joys of an art form whose essence is the language of the body in motion, even as it involves language, sound, and sight. The title of this session, Between Two Worlds, The Artist in a Religious Culture, seemed appropriate enough to me at first, but has since caused me also to stop and reconsider. The idea that an artist is somewhat of a displaced person, not allowing him or herself to be part of the secular realm, but not quite being accepted into the spiritual realm, seems a little inaccurate to me. On the contrary, I view artists as some of the few who are all too aware of their position within the scheme of things. For them, there is no cleft between sacred and profane. Kind of reminds me of the scripture, "Wherefore verily I say unto you that all things unto me are spiritual, and not at any time have I given unto you a law that was temporal." Mircea Eliade wrote in a fascinating book entitled Myth and Reality, "We should see that artists, far from being the neurotics they are often said to be, are on the contrary more healthy psychically than many modern men. The artists have set themselves to destroying their world in order to recreate an artistic universe in which man can at once live and contemplate and dream. It seems to me that artists are not caught between two worlds, but are attempting to create such a world, a singular world where one can live and contemplate and dream. However clear this artistic vision seems, or however it seems, it's difficult to communicate to others. And hence the frustration is not living between worlds, but rather seeing other people living two lives simultaneously, one secular and one spiritual, and trying through art to help them understand and bridge the gap. I suppose my greatest frustration with Mormon culture, and I think with American culture in general, is our acceptance of mediocrity. We want things that are quick and easy and comfortable. We buy paintings that fit the size of our sofa. We buy movies that have a lot of special effects because I think our imaginations can no longer conjure up the images. Even Sesame Street, that provides a mother a few precious moments of solitude, teaches children to expect information and solutions to problems to be cleverly packaged and efficiently and immediately delivered. And I think that happens often in our teaching in the church also. Along with my distaste for mediocrity, I am becoming increasingly leery of labels. And to borrow a term from the Sunstone Review, and I wince when I read the title of the column, "Mormon Media Image," I reject the possibility that who I am and what I represent could be jingled, hyped, promoted, or distorted by the advertising community. Even the quest for Mormon art that I was so passionately caught up in a few years ago is slowing down as I try to decide if that holy grail really exists and or is worth the search. Antonin Artaud, a French actor and critic of modern theater, wrote some wonderfully mad, crazy things that contain a sobering amount of truth. And he wrote this: "When we speak of the word life, it must be understood we are not referring to life as we know it from its surface of fact, but to that fragile, fluctuating center which forms never reach. And if there is still one hellish, truly accursed thing in our time, it is our artistic dallying with forms, instead of being like victims burnt at the stake, signaling through the flames." Mediocrity survives on the surface of fact. It doesn't require thought or feeling, and to rid ourselves of mediocrity, we must force ourselves to feel again. And now, two dance-specific frustrations. The paradox of the body as the instrument or medium. You know, on one hand, in the church, we're taught that to view the as carnal, devil, or carnal, sensual, and devilish. And on the other hand, we know that the purpose of this life is to gain a body, is, if you'll pardon the expression, to get physical. And that we know that the body is a temple, it's a temple of our spirits. We constantly battle the urges within us to suppress and express our natural drives and desires. And these contradictory attitudes often confuse both dancer and observer as to the propriety of dance as an art form. Also, I've found this a lot, that there's something disquieting and uncomfortable about watching a human form. We've actually experienced every movement within the human body's capacity. This everyday movement and gesture which dance borrows. Now, dance just borrows this everyday movement that we all are aware of, but they alter it a little bit, abstract it, make it look a little bit strange, and this bizarre, abstract, strange movement just becomes inhuman, and it scares people. The audience wants to be able to answer Yeats' concluding question in Among School Children, yes, we can know the dancer from the dance. We have to be able to, when in reality you can't. And a lot of questions we get as dancers is, after something is over, what in the world did that dance mean? What was that all about? Thus, the dancer finds him or herself in the exhausting position of both educating and exhilarating an audience. Educating the audience to the fact that dance need not look familiar nor tell a literal story to be understood, and exhilarating an audience by the discovery of the kinesthetic or muscle sense, which causes the observers to feel, I'm talking almost literally, to feel the leaping and whirling of a dancer, so much so that they are practically lifted out of their seats. Despite the frustrations with mediocrity, misunderstanding, and insensitivity, the rewards of dancing make it almost impossible for me to stop. I believe there is a need for dance at this moment in time. It offers a power that is vital, perhaps essential, to man's sagging faith. The need is not for dance in the form of entertainment that's so readily accessible via the media. Neither is there need for dance in the form of elitist activity in which only highly skilled professionals participate. I believe that everyone can and should dance. Man should dance in celebration of his aliveness, for enjoyment of his magnificent body, and as praise to God who gave these gifts. During the years I spent performing and teaching with the Ryrie Woodbury Dance Company and the Brigham Young University Dancers Company, I have realized the importance of dance for everyone, regardless of age or sex. Both dance companies sponsored parent-child evenings in the communities where they were performing and teaching. And I cherish my memories of watching a mother and her 10-year-old son take turns manipulating each other's arms, legs, torsos, heads into off-balance, unusual shapes with the care and sensitivity of a sculptor working with Carrara marble. Or watching a burly father hoist his kindergarten daughter high over his head in a breathtaking pose while the young girl smiles at him with complete trust and love. Watching this reawakening of sensitivity in individuals, a discovery of what it is like to think and feel with the body, is satisfying and exciting. To help people begin to feel comfortable with their bodies, to even like them. To even like them for the amazing things that they can do, and to help people find acceptable expression of human drives without guilt or remorse, enables this artist to piece together, albeit slowly, a world where one can live and contemplate and dream. Martha Graham, the matriarch of modern dance, said this type of reawakening through dance gives power to the individual. It is not a mere matter of having a good time, but of disciplined work that leads to freedom. She said, throughout the performance of these technical exercises, a woman remains a woman and a man, because power means to become what one is to the highest degree of realization. Perhaps the most personal experience that keeps me trying to be an artist in dance is the pursuit of something a mentor of mine, Shirley Ryrie, called transcendence. I can best define this phenomenon by comparing it to personal revelation or the spirit bearing witness of truth. Perhaps they're all one and the same, I'm not sure. And by describing the following event to you. It was one of those rare evenings when you could feel that the audience was accepting your gift. Their energy was warm, generous, and pouring past the footlights. We all felt good about each other, what we were doing, and the evening in general. It had been a while since we had sensed that kind of unity in the group. The music of Brahms was neither swallowing us up or carrying us along, as it does so often. It was a nice relationship of mutual understanding. The choreography was simple. I could teach it to everyone in this room in about 1 minute, but it was stunning in its simplicity. Somehow, in 1 or 2 seconds in the midst of this ambience, I felt my head open up and pure knowledge flow in. I could tell you everything there was to know about my body at that moment, its shape from the stretch of my toe to the arch of my neck. I could write a book about what those 3 joyful movements meant. I could hear every instrument playing in the orchestra singly as well as collectively. I knew everything there was to know about that moment and about myself. And then it passed. I continue to dance to relive that moment again. Thank you.
I tried to be a teacher and found that it was too hard for me, and part of it is it takes so much energy to say what you feel with words when that's not your medium. So what I've decided to do today is I want to tell you 4 things, short things that don't connect. It's the way I always talk. They're thoughts that I have on a recurring basis. I've got to tell you why I chose to do that. One of my great gifts is to be able to put things off. And I make art by building things that I like the shape of, with standing colors around in bottles and letting them distill for months, and then one day when you feel capable, you go in and put it all together. And if you don't like it at the end of the day, you take it all apart and look at it again for a couple of months. Part of the reason that I want to give you these disconnected thoughts is because I'm not as sure of how I feel about religion and art as some of the ones that have spoken before me. It still doesn't tie together for me. I've worked a lot with the church architect, and I've spent a lot of time specifically working on placing sculptures with the church and working on temple projects and so forth. So, in terms of this church and any other church, any other religion, art has 2 purposes. One is to express their philosophical view of life and how their religion ties God and the world and people all together. My opinion is that you can feel well assured that when the church needs something to do that, they get it right away. They don't have to struggle to have that kind of art, whether it's music, illustration, writing, and so forth, to project their views on things. The second type of art is one that it should be with our feelings of spirituality akin to art, but is not, and that is the need that a lot of people don't understand of pure expression. And I appreciate it, and I can't remember your name. You just spoke, Georgette. I really related to what she said about dancing, and that's the closest thing to making art to me, and that is the expression, the expressive part of putting a piece of steel next to another piece of steel and have it hang there and feel the magic. I mean, it's the same thing as a poem that I've learned to like that I read recently by James Merrill. There are two lines. One of the lines is, "And suddenly, bird glance." Another one of the lines is, "Slabs of dogma." And when those visual, those images come to us, and you hear that, you're just touched. I remember I read an essay by Dylan Thomas once, and he said in that, "Ride a cock horse to Banbury Cross to see a fine lady upon a white horse. Rings on her fingers and bells on her toes. She will have music wherever she goes." The only reason that that's lasted for 100 years is because it's so fun to say. It's the only reason. It's the reason why children will say it over and over again. And it'll jingle, if you teach it to your kids, it'll jingle in your head at least several times a day for months. The challenge between the two worlds. The challenge comes for me very closely associated to a conversation I had with a person one time. This guy was explaining to me about a relationship he had with his father, and it was really a hard one. He said he'd be working on a pump or in the field and say, "Go get me a hammer." And I'd run like crazy down to the barn, down to the shed, search through the drawers and the shelves to find the hammer, try to make a decision whether to get the big one, the little one, the claw hammer, the ball peen hammer, whatever. Run back to the pump, say, "Here it is, Dad," and he'd say, "You were too slow, I used a rock." When you realize you have a gift for seeing or listening or singing or dancing, you get anticipation as to how you're going to project that gift to the world, because I think it's a basic need of everybody to be expressive in that way. All too often in our culture, and very frankly, especially find it in the LDS culture, those of us who have gifts have been asked to go to the garage and get a hammer. And we run like crazy and we look like crazy and we come up with the best thing we've got. And when we get back, basically the statement is, "It's the wrong hammer, you're too slow, I used a rock." We're a church which is an extension of middle class America. We are not a unique people, really, socially. We're middle class America. We have our roots of understanding built around the media. And art language is difficult to come by. Art language gives you a lasting joy. But the guy next door said, like the t-shirt on his boy, his weightlifter son, "No pain, no gain." That's the way it is in the arts. Basically, as an LDS, middle class American people, we have the challenge to work for a better understanding of our society and civilization, that what we so easily get comes to us through the media. Therefore, as religious people, we are generally literary, and although we shouldn't be, although we should be more spiritual, we find ourselves being more logical and avoiding the very need to reach out and touch each other. And it's interesting, as I sit on the panel you want to reach out and touch, and there's something that stands in the way that says, be formal, don't fall on your face, say something profound, entertain. And yet for all of us, and I think that we all understand, if you're here today, I think you have enough background to understand that emotionally touching is somewhat foreign to our culture right now. And emotionally touching is foreign because of our culture, is foreign to our church because our church is so much a part of it. Last statement. Martin Clark wrote a good paper. Can you remember where that was, Dennis? That article you gave me, what did it come out of? Anyway, I think it was with Sunstone, maybe, last year. Criticized the production of Star Child at the BYU campus, criticized the attendance of the people and the amount of people that went to it, and offered, it was an excellent article, but at the end offered as an alternative to Star Child, which he considered fairly light, whimsical, and not in keeping with the same tone of the subject matter in which it was trying to project. In other words, it was light and in keeping with quite an important subject matter. Offered as the answer to that, the Redeemer, which is one of the musical, one of the more successful musical, religiously musical Mormon musical attempts that's been made. And my fleeting thought was, therein to me lies the struggle of the Mormon artist, because to answer someone's earnestness to project the gospel in a more pop fashion versus the other person need to pursue Mormon values in an art that had more of a traditional serious effect. In both areas, I saw that the struggle and the need and the to go get the hammer interfering with the ability that we all going to have to come to grips with as we're expressive Mormon artists. And that is the feeling of trying to understand ourselves and not in terms of the importance, this tremendous amount of importance that has to be placed on everything we do.
Thank you, panelists, for your personal sharing of your many ideas. Are there any questions that you would like to direct to the panel, or are there questions that you would like to ask of each other? They might prove to be interesting. Yes.
I know that there isn't a lot of time, but I would like rather to ask a question just to make an observation to the panel. I know how to express it to be like an artist, but I think what he showed us and shared with us, he fits with the other core, and so I make that to him as well. Listening to these five people today has been a really special experience for me, because I've been in other situations so often, which we all relate to people as artists, in which what they have expressed is so frustrating that what is the agenda? I think these people today have expressed to us what art consists of, because they were allowed themselves to be vulnerable. And that's just very necessary practice.
Thank you. I agree. There were some other hands, weren't there? Didn't I see another hand? Panelists, do you have questions of each other? Come on. You're not so bad.
I'd like to ask Linda if we did disagree about use.
Oh, that's right. Grab that mic. I believe it's on. And Linda?
Is it on? Yeah.
Yes, it is.
Not very well. Do we disagree about use? What we mean by use? That notion turned up in many of our minds. I mean, Neil was just talking about, go to the garage and get me a hammer.